On this episode of Roots, Race, and Culture.
Is artificial intelligence biased?
AI begins with us, right? With human beings who are creating this, and we're flawed.
Hear from our guests as they share what their research and creative applications of AI reveal.
I look at the way that AI is changing our expectations of ourselves and of others, so we can really see how is it that we're being told by AI that we're not good enough and that we should be different.
Join us for Roots, Race, and Culture.
Funding for Roots, Race, and Culture is provided in part by the Norman C. and Barbara L. Tanner Charitable Support Trust and by donations to PBS Utah from viewers like you. Thank you.
Hello, my friends, and welcome to Roots, Race, and Culture, where we bring you into candid conversations about shared cultural experiences. I'm Lonzo Liggins.
And I'm Daynor Gerald. Thank you for joining us. AI is integrating into all aspects of our daily lives. In fact, AI technology is approaching the singularity. This is the point in which artificial intelligence surpasses human intelligence, and it's happening much faster than experts ever expected. As we approach this new frontier in human history, how does AI skew our view of the world, and how is it impacting different cultures and our understanding of what it means to be human?
That's right. So to explore this topic, we have two experts with us who are studying and applying AI in their work and in their art. Gretchen, introduce yourself, please.
Hi, I'm Gretchen Andrew, and I'm very passionate about making parts of AI visible so that we can talk about it. I'm particularly doing this through a series called Facetune Portraits, where I look at the way that AI is changing our expectations of ourselves and of others by physicalizing the process of beauty filters that make lips bigger and waist skinnier. And we see them all the time on social media. We see them as a filter on Zoom video conferencing, but we don't really see what's going on. Mm-hmm. I turn that process into a series of marks and scars so we can really see how is it that we're being told by AI that we're not good enough and that we should be different.
Wow. Yo, I can't wait to see and show some of your art. That's awesome. And now we have Avery. Please introduce yourself, Avery.
Sure. Avery Holton. I'm chair of the Department of Communication at the University of Utah, where we have over $100 million investment in responsible AI uses. Mm-hmm. What that means for me is researching and trying to find ways for people to integrate AI into their daily lives, but in really helpful ways so that AI can be a little less scary and maybe a little more fun to use, but also can have a significant and positive impact on people's lives and their well-being and happiness.
Okay, all right. Well, thank you for joining us in this conversation. You guys are both experts in this field, and I'm really appreciative that you're here. Now, Avery, you mentioned that you want to use and you're learning and developing ways to use AI in a positive way. Tell us a little bit about how you see AI changing the way that people see who they are.
Such a great question, right? AI is reshaping our identity, whether it's really the art that we channel that through, or the ways we work, or we find and discover ourselves. And we can see that happening maybe most readily in our professional lives, that blending of the professional and personal, where AI has helped us with mundane tasks like calendars, emails, outlining, and maybe freed up a little bit more time for us to spend with our kids, or spend skiing, or spend on maybe art, like Gretchen will tell us about. But really trying to find the ways to destigmatize AI as just a negative tool, as just a tool to replace jobs, or to threaten different elements of our lives, and instead to see the benefit, how AI can help us, and maybe even bring us back to the artisanal, the creative, the individual works by giving us more time and giving us a little bit more direction.
So that's a great jumping off point there. You specialize in working with the artistic aspect of what people look like and how AI is being used to reshape how people look. We've been using a form of AI called like airbrushing or touching things up, but explain in a little bit more detail how you're using AI to reorganize how people view people's looks.
Yeah, so the truth is we're already using this AI through beauty filters, through an app called Facetune and many others. These apps use AI to identify parts of our body and to enhance them, to make them more beautiful. So really in my artistic practice, I don't invent any of the AI. I take it from culture. Whatever's trending on TikTok is the filter that I apply. It starts as a painted photograph. It's a lot like when you get a photo printed on a birthday cake. It's a similar process, but I've got a special sense of set of printers. And then the photograph is wet. It's made of oil paint. Mm-hmm. I give it to a robot that then makes the same modifications that would invisibly move pixels around on TikTok or Instagram. But because it's moving paint, as it enlarges the lips or makes the waist skinnier, for men give a different jaw or a bicep, it becomes this messy mark and scar that shows this tension between who we are and who AI is telling us we should be.
I'd like to see an example of this. We actually have a video.
Yeah, let's jump
take
in the
a
video
look at this video and this see thing. Exactly what you're talking about.
What is universal beauty? This is the question that the Miss Universe pageant contestants aims to answer. 120 contestants from all over the world represent what quintessential beauty looks like from each country. What happens when these universally beautiful women are subject to the algorithmic Facetune filters? Facetune Portraits explores AI beauty filters through traditional oil painting. Using custom robotics, I translate social media filters into physical paintings, revealing how AI-driven beauty standards are homogenizing diverse faces and bodies across cultures. Each portrait exposes the tension between natural features and AI modifications, making visible the digital alterations that silently shape our social media presence.
Wow.
So this is really spectacular. I want to show like a full-size version of these paintings so people could see the impact that they have. But before I do that, I'm looking at this process, and that is extremely technical. Are you using AI? Like, give us a little bit about your background. You got to be pretty smart with technology to pull that off.
Yeah, well, it's interesting what Avery was saying earlier about tech for good and sort of tech for positive. I was educated in information systems, and I worked in Silicon Valley. And I was just seeing technology used to manipulate our attention, sell us things we don't need. And I very much believed in it as a tool of personal transformation. So when I left tech, I knew nobody in the art world. I had no hard skills. I had no craft. I just knew that an artist is someone who gets to self-define, to be celebrated for who they are. And so I really had my education in becoming an artist on the internet, through the internet.
Wow.
And really what I'm passionate about is making something that's usually invisible in technology and making it visible so that we can talk about it and also be less afraid of it and really be making more choices about it, have some of that agency back.
Okay, not only do we have images on the screen of these beautiful paintings, but we actually have one here in the studio. So let's have Gretchen explain to us, show us this image and what's happening and how it was created.
Yeah, thank you. So what you're looking at here is an oil painting where the initial photograph was created in paint. This is me. And while that painting was still wet, I gave it to a robot. And that robot applied the same beauty filter that is used all the time on TikTok and on Instagram, on LinkedIn and Zoom. But normally, it's invisibly moving pixels. But here, because it's moving paint, it makes a literal scar. I say that this work shows the invisible scars of social media filters. And so we see here it's making the lips bigger and it's making the boobs enlarged and straightening out my extremely crooked nose. And what we see in this is everywhere there's a painted mark in these red and white lines is somewhere that AI disagrees with how my body looks. And this allows us to see those differences that are normally hidden and to talk about whether or not we think that's okay. It's amazing to me that with what is less than 8 brush strokes here that a robot does create, this begins to not look like me so quickly.
Yeah.
And it almost looks like the uncanny valley in reverse, where to me this begins to look like an AI-generated person who's failing to look real. And we are actually meeting that AI aesthetic halfway. We are changing our bodies digitally and then through plastic surgery to look fake.
Yeah. Mm. So now that begs the question, isn't it safer to do it digitally versus actually going in and scarring our body and doing plastic surgery? Or is it just as bad mentally for us? What do you think?
They're so connected, because what's happening is as we see ourselves on screen and then try and communicate those 3 dimensions on screen, we start to think this is how we're supposed to look. And then we look in the mirror and say, oh, I don't like how I look anymore. And the British Psychological Society published a study that this is more damaging when we do it on ourselves. And because that expectation changes, we then want to go in and get the plastic surgeries. Yeah. They're all connected.
I think there needs to be a radical self-actualization in our society that we do not have to actually describe this perfection standard of beauty, because it just doesn't exist, and it just is something that we've invented.
Right.
And it's something, it is not actually, it's in the mind of somebody, but well, not in the mind of everybody, because like beauty, he's not going to think the same thing, you're not going to think the same thing, I'm not going to think the same thing.
The beauty in humanity is the differences between all of us, in my opinion, you know, like the people from Brazil look different than people from Asia and Japan, and looks different from people from Zurich, I think you said you were at in this photo. And I think that's what's beautiful, is that we are different. But apparently that's that colonization of our bodies, that homogenization of our view of aesthetics, is that's not the way we're meant to be. And but it's somehow being
revolutionized.
It's just seeping it into our minds there.
We need a standard of beauty revolution. We really do. We really do. I mean, it hasn't happened, but we need that more than anything now, because it's just not the same. It's not the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And the 40s and 50s and 60s is when that really started to blossom and become this big thing. But now all of a sudden, we all see beauty differently, but yet now we're being told, no, this is beauty, and we're all, and like, 80% of the population is like, I don't see that as beautiful.
At the end of the day, we're told that that's beautiful because that can be monetized.
Right.
So, and I think that's what we were getting at.
Right.
So, all right. Well, thank you for bringing
the
painting on. I would say it's a beautiful self-portrait, but I don't know if that's the right thing to say.
It was a beautiful self-portrait before AI got a hold of it.
It's beautiful because it's your work of art, I'll say
that.
Well, and I always think of them as portraits of tension, that I wanted to be able to make two portraits in one, how we actually look and how we're told to look, messily coexisting. Because even when we do try and be our full selves online, it's not a perfect fit, and it is messy, and all of us have that experience.
Oh, that's great. So let's take a look at more paintings here that were created by Gretchen. Can you tell us a little bit? We have Miss USA, Miss Puerto Rico. What year is this? What are we looking at?
So I've been working with the Miss Universe contestants because they are already gorgeous. They're from all over the world. They should look completely different. And what also is happening with these apps is there's a homogenization of the beauty standard that is internationally spreading like wildfire because of AI. And so in working with the Miss Universe contestants, we can see the absurdity and also the diversity compression that's occurring.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The two that we're looking at here were acquired by the Whitney Museum of Art in New York recently. And these contestants have really been very positively involved in this process. The Miss Great Britain came to my opening in London, Miss Jamaica came by the New York opening.
Wow.
And really nobody knows better than them how absurd it is that they aren't good enough. If they're not good enough for these algorithms, for this AI standard, no one has any hope of ever being good enough.
And I want to see the one where there's like you up against the photos, just to show how big those photos actually are. Can we pull that up real quick?
Yeah, these are large paintings.
Yeah, so these are actually pretty big paintings, yeah, as you can see.
They're 48 inches tall, so a little bit smaller than human size. But in that vertical format, you do feel, especially when you're in a room of many of them, you see the difference in the painting, the difference in the women. But then again, that similarity in what AI wants to do. It wants to give Miss Jamaica the same body as Miss Finland, who shouldn't have the same face as Miss Philippines. It doesn't matter where you start, the destination is the same.
Yeah, and I want to jump into something real quick, because you mentioned something, Avery. You said $100 million that's being used, that's being mostly used towards making AI helpful. What about AI do you think isn't helpful? What do you think about AI that could be harmful, that is out there, that could be causing issues, in your opinion?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we can do is remember that AI, even if it feels robotic or digital or distant, begins with us, right? With human beings who are creating this, and we're flawed. And even if we're creating algorithms to drive AI. They're being driven by our own biases, our own perceptions, our own stigmas, and just the ways that we can see in the artwork, right? Perceptions maybe of beauty that are standard in the US that maybe aren't in Europe or in other countries. Mm-hmm. But if the builders of these systems are positioned in one specific area and aren't able to go international yet, that can really present problems and can present a negative to us because it peripheralizes certain communities. It makes certain assumptions about people and their own standards, whether it's beauty or socioeconomics mm-hmm. or something more culturally related. That can be a significant challenge, aside from all of the hallucinations that AI can have and the misinformation that it can spread and those sorts of things. So there's still a burden on us, or maybe an opportunity on us as human beings to point those out and to be assistive, not only with AI in correcting things, which we now can do, but also with those who are creating and behind the scenes. And that's where the University of Utah and other universities across the country are making deep investments, mm-hmm. is making sure that they're supporting people who are creating these tools, and making sure that they're going into the community and impacting areas like veteran healthcare, cancer health and treatment, animation and technology, arts and entertainment, across the board opportunities for us to really engage and improve the lives of one another.
When we say helpful from both of you, what do you see when you hear the word that AI can be helpful? And I'm curious on your end, Gretchen, how you think AI would be actually helpful when it comes to the research and the work that you're doing?
Well, one of the things I think we see with AI is it does allow us to do things quite quickly. Mm-hmm. But what's happening also within that is every website now looks the same, every home is now designed the same, everyone now has the same face. And there's so much focus on AI as an explosion of productivity and creativity. But I actually think that we're going to see it playing out in our lives as a system of control and of surveillance and of normalization, because that's just what the machine finds easy. Mm. And if we're all using the same tools to write the next great American novel, we're gonna get a lot of the same great next American novel.
Great, right. That's very good.
Okay, so, I'm curious about this, and let's just sort of throw this out for everybody. What happens to communities that are already marginalized who don't have access to this technology? Can AI be used to help educate those people, or is it something that they're going to get left behind because they don't understand or they're not using this stuff on a regular basis? So, like, you know, the person who gets the job is the person who's most productive, and that person usually uses AI. So what do you guys think about that for people who are already struggling? How do they keep up?
Yeah, I can kick that off with some data from the research side. So we know now that many K-12 programs in the U.S. are using AI and making use and making it accessible through partnerships with larger corporations like Microsoft or NVIDIA or Adobe and other systems. And that's great. That's a really good starting point. If more than half of our K-12 programs are already using that and centering AI as a tool to achieve success or to find happiness or to make tasks easier, that's fantastic. What we're running into, though, is that accessibilities of digital technology and also the creation of those technologies have long been driven by particular stigmas, by particular peripheralizations, right, that tend to focus on the populations that are easier to deconstruct or easier mm-hmm. to understand, or they're just seen more, right? Mm-hmm. So, for example, if we see more white bodies in TV programming and on the media, and then we ask AI to assist us in creating a journalism broadcast, what we're likely to see are those same white bodies, right? Mm. So we're asking different communities now to go further into AI and have to actually ask different questions and ask AI to go on a deeper journey with them than other communities, right? And not to make it a dichotomous issue, but AI itself does want to learn depending on the platform and does want input, especially agentic AI, these new AI systems. Mm-hmm. But we have to know the right questions to ask.
Right.
And how do we know if we're not talking to each other or across communities what those questions are?
What about you, Gretchen? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, so I'm a big fan of what I call productive uncertainty in our own lives, where when we bring kids to an art museum or when we as adults experience art, one of the things that happens is we see something that we wouldn't have made, something that could not have come from us. Mm-hmm. And our brains don't really know what to do with that otherness. And that otherness, that disruption of the system, is, I think, why art is so powerful. It expands us. But when AI is forced to reconcile something that it can't take as an input, it just disregards it. Mm-hmm. So if you take embodied knowledge, oral history, other traditions that are more prevalent outside of the West as forms of knowledge, they're not part of AI, because AI can't go around and ask us all how we're feeling and how that was danced and what knowledge is passed in ways that are not text-based, image-based, mm-hmm. Western in its standards. And so not only is that knowledge not incorporated into AI, it is disregarded because it's a different form. Mm. And AI is ultimately a system of inputs and outputs with a big black box in the middle. Right. And a lot of programming, a lot of interesting knowledge takes place there. But I think we have to think very carefully about what's being disregarded. And I don't think it's impossible to incorporate some of these things. But we are very deep into a world where we don't incorporate this. Wikipedia, for example, big source of knowledge for AI. But to get something written on Wikipedia, you have to have new sources that cite it, and that's how it's deemed to be credible. There weren't a lot of news sources writing about a lot of communities, about a lot of different races, about a lot of different genders. Yeah. And so if that knowledge wasn't documented by the journalist of the day or today, it couldn't be incorporated into Wikipedia.
So there's a chance of loss of information is what you're saying over time.
We actually asked a question. We had our producers ask a question to ask what a story, a log line of what our show would be like. Here's the prompt. The prompt says, hi, what can I help you with? It says, please create an image illustrating a talk show with two hosts. The topic of the talk show is about the experiences and perspectives of BIPOC people in Utah. Enter.
Let's see
what
it says we're supposed to look like here.
Well, it ain't, that's, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that looks like me, you.
No, that
that's good though.
Like you. They turned me into a girl.
That's not bad. I mean, it's generic.
This is done by Microsoft Copilot, and what are your thoughts as you see this image? I'm curious what you guys think.
I noticed actually at first the dress, right. And there's a lot that's also going on with AI's use on LinkedIn, where people are feeding it a bunch of images from parties or their personal lives and asking to be made into a professional image. Mm-hmm. And that professionalization that we saw on that image is a very Western specific idea of what it would mean to be a talk show host. And I much prefer what you guys are wearing.
Avery.
This is pretty good, right?
Yeah,
so
right.
Copilot hit it here pretty well. It's interesting though too to see that the prompt itself said nothing specific to who the hosts were, gender, race, or otherwise, what you were wearing, what the actual feel of the show might be. Mm-hmm. So for Copilot, right, that it only has a certain number of clues right. that we've given it, but it's chosen to be somewhat gender neutral, which is interesting,
yeah.
But it's also chosen to see the topic of the show and then to assume what the hosts would look like, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Without asking for any more input. And certainly we could go down the prompting pathway and eventually actually get to something that looks like the set here and,
right.
and the both of you as well. But we have to take all of those steps again and, mm-hmm. and have that conversation, which there's a benefit, right, to having that conversation with AI. But there's also a drawback knowing, hey, if we just give one prompt, this is exactly what it's going to tell us this should look like.
Yeah, it's
right.
going to be the most generic version.
And you mentioned earlier, you mentioned a bevy of topics. You said that you talked about healthcare, you talked about art, you talked about a few other things. In what areas in AI that you've noticed during your research has AI been the most effective? Because I've heard that in healthcare, that's actually going to be a really good thing because it's going to minimize a lot of the research that's going to be happening. And I've also heard that in legal work, like as far as paralegals and stuff like that, that's going to minimize the type of work that people have to do. In what areas is AI really going to help us in society?
Yeah, I think thinking about it two ways, professionally and then personally, helps, right? So professionally, we've seen AI speed up tasks, right? When it comes to cancer research, for example, we've seen it be able to take on large amounts of information and data and point researchers in new directions, or help them think about directions they haven't been on, or help astronomers identify distant stars or the makeup of those in a much quicker pace that allows for a whole new realm of exploration here, right? Frees up time for our scientists to be thinking about those things. Also, you know, to make a connection to the beauty industry, we know that the beauty industry is one of the more accepting industries of the LGBTQ plus community, of all sorts of different communities in that space. What the beauty industry, though, is doing is also saying, sure, come in, you're welcome, but it's using AI to connect with those communities and individuals to open space for them in ways that weren't possible before. So think if you're being challenged to open your own barbershop, right? And what that means, you have to know Excel, you have to know financing, you have to know communication, spreadsheets, all these sorts of things. AI can now do a lot of that for us on the professional side. So a lot of help in that regard. But on the personal side, again, AI has been helping us for a while, or maybe hurting us in some ways by giving us Spotify wraps and other things. We saw just this week that Gemini and Google launched a whole new app feature so you can be in your car and actually point out things. Hey, there's an accident, without having to touch anything now. Just talk about it and AI will learn from you, but with others around you, making life easier and simpler. But the one thing that AI continues to do that I find most beneficial is opening up free time for us, again, as human beings, to see one another, to see the art that we're producing, to see the different hairstyles that can be created with that little bit of extra time, but then also taking that home with us so that work doesn't have to come home with us as often as it has in the past, and we can put it down, right? We can challenge ourselves to put down that work, put down the phone, and AI can help us reconnect with one another at a time when, frankly, we've lost that, right? We've seen
100%.
Yeah, that's a lot of our generation has complained about, you know, with cell phones and other things, it's like you never stop working, right? And so the idea of being able to get some of that time back is pretty appealing. Now, Gretchen, we had some conversations before the show, and you've done a lot of research as well, some things that aren't really being looked at in other ways. Can you tell us what's been most exciting or revelatory in the research that you've done?
Well, exciting because I think it's important. So one of the things that's also happening is young people are seeing faces and bodies that literally do not exist.
Right.
We used to have celebrities on the silver screen, on the big screen. Mm-hmm. Now our celebrities are on our phone, and we might see a photo of Kim Kardashian, and then ourselves, and then our friend, and then another celebrity. And the context compression that's happening there is young people are comparing themselves and saying, I could never look like that. They don't even look like that.
Right.
And even when we have that literacy, it's really disrupting our expectations of how we are supposed to look, and at very young ages. Mm-hmm. So people are coming with these apps, these Facetune apps. They're coming to plastic surgeons and they're saying, make me look like this. Mm. But they're always showing a two-dimensional image. And a lot of these beauty standards are being driven by our desire to communicate our full body in two dimensions. So big lips, pointy jaws. We don't care how those lips look from the side because we actually are prioritizing that two-dimensional still image. Yeah. And that need to communicate that, because we are seeing each other on Zoom, we're seeing ourselves processed through these screens and through our cameras. When the new iPhone comes out, the camera doesn't got better because it gives us more pixels. Like, we've had the ability to put photos on billboards for like a decade now with the iPhone. What changes is the algorithmic processing, usually of our faces and our bodies. And it's this constant beauty arms race where we think we need to change something, and we start to think we don't look right, and how insidious that is for old people, or older people, I mean, just not children. But with children, we're seeing body dysmorphia.
A lot of it.
We're seeing teen suicide, as this is referenced in instances of teen suicide. And I think it just connects to any time we're told that we need to be different or that we're not good enough. That, I think it's great to try and enjoy that time with our families, but I think what happens is we put down the phone and we don't feel right going into that. We don't feel like we look at the mirror and we say, that's not how I'm supposed to look.
Gretchen, I have a two-part question for you. Number one is, do you have a personal connection with like wanting this to, you know, to be a part of you know, changing people's perspectives of this, number one? But number two, how do we change that? And where did this become very passionate for you?
Well, as I approach my 40s, I'm, you know, spending a lot of money on skincare and, you know, debating.
It's working.
Thank you.
I wouldn't have guessed you were near your 40s.
almost 40s. You know, debating whether or not I inject poisonous stuff into my face. I've been thinking a lot about any time we are told that we should be a different shape, whether it's metaphorically or, you know, literally. And I think it also comes from just this desire that I don't really just see a desire to be beautiful with these apps. I see a fear of ourselves because it does give us all the same face, at all the same body. It commodifies the self. It colonizes the body. That we're fearful of how we actually are. We're fearful of aging. We're fearful of death. And now it's not just that we're supposed to feel bad about that. We're supposed to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars fixing it. There are so many capitalized solutions now where we're being sold both the problem and the solution. And I don't personally want to do it, so I would like it to stop for everybody.
I find it bizarre because I think most men, a lot of men I know at least, that's not like what I'm looking for, like a lot of men. I'm not looking for like this total plastic person, where I think a lot of men tend to be looking for someone who's more real, but there's this huge industry out there saying that that's not what we're looking for. It's almost like telling us as men, this is what you're supposed to like, and it's like, well, but that's not actually what I like. So, and everyone's different,
right? I have a question about that. So like these things that are happening, and understanding AI is much more complicated than everybody seems to think, right? It can think for itself, et cetera. But isn't it controlled by an algorithm that was programmed by a human being? Is it actually thinking for itself, or is it doing processes that mimic thinking for itself? Because then that begs the question, well, who programmed it to say this is what's beautiful, right? So can you guys help us understand that?
Sure. So AI, and I'm not a computer scientist, so I'll explain it as well as I know, and I think we both can. Really right now, what's available to the public are two forms of AI. There's one that's been with us for a few years now that we're used to, right? This is like the ChatGPT, the conversational AI, large the task-oriented, right? These large language models where we input data and out comes something. We input a command and out comes something. And we can have a conversation, but really there's not something there yet telling us, hey, I'm learning alongside you, and here's the better choice for today. Agentic AI, that second form, is what we're beginning to experience and what's starting to show up for us in new formats of AI or new updates.
What's agentic for?
So agentic AI essentially is still inputting commands or having conversations, but allowing the AI to actually learn, right? To either learn from mistakes or learn from your habits, or in some cases have access to more of your information, which can opens
that's
up a whole other can of worms,
but
learns with you, right? So it's not just giving you a broad answer of, should I go outside today? Yes or no. And instead, knowing about you. Okay, do you like crowds? Are you saddened when you see clouds? Do you like sunny skies? Like learning with you and giving you a different kind of response along the way. And not just to each individual, but again, to those bigger companies that are making use of it, so that AI can learn and become self-sufficient and move toward what was mentioned at the beginning of the show as just being its own entity that's thinking for and of itself. And that's really, we're there. We're already using it in some ways that we don't even know about. But in the next couple of years, it'll be right there alongside us, if not in physical form. We're not talking about a robot or a humanoid or something like that. But in speaker form, in phone form, and all these other forms to really help us if we want. I think the trick will be making sure that we stay centered, right? That human
that's
beings
the trick.
There's the elephant in the room. And I think that's the biggest elephant in the room you just brought up. where do we all stand? Like, there's a lot of people right now, I'm talking billions of people probably across the world who are saying, where are we gonna be useful when this AI thing starts to really take shape and starts to roll out? Because there's a lot of fear. There's a lot of worry and concern that AI is going to not only replace jobs, it's going to replace artists, it's going to replace people who have put humans, people who have put their whole lives and their whole, years and years in college on the line to do these professions. Where do we stand in art? Where do we stand in careers?
Well, and the other side of that coin is relationships, right? I've read articles of a woman. People develop these close relationships with an AI to the point where, when I think it was, I can't remember the ChatGPT company. They had released a version that talked, but because of some complaints, they had made it talk a little more robotically versus expressively, and a lot of people were very upset about that because
Scarlett Johansson sued.
Yes.
And I don't know if this is exactly what you're speaking about, but Sam Altman from OpenAI apparently called Scarlett Johansson and said, "We'd like to use your voice. You were great in Her." And she said, "No." And then it came out and it sounded a lot like Scarlett Johansson.
Yeah.
So she sued. And so that might have also been part of that, is basically, did they use her to train that? Did they have to roll it back?
Yeah, and if I heard a story about a woman who went with her friend to go hiking up into the mountains, and they specifically planned their trip to stay close enough to be connected to the internet so that she could have her device with her AI boyfriend present throughout this trip, right? And so her and her friend would sit down and look up at the stars, and it would tell her about the constellations and that sort of thing. So what you were hinting at earlier about learning about us and stuff, it's for the time, right? We saw that, you know, a lot of apps are about time and attention now. That's the currency. And now it's weaving into relationships, right? Our human interactions are becoming increasingly targeted toward the AI because they might feel like it connects to them, it understands them, it listens better than the average human being.
Yeah. Our jobs at stake.
Well, or just our relationships.
Like our jobs and relationships at stake. I think that's a big question a lot of people have.
So I guess I'm curious to hear what your thoughts are about that. I mean, there's certainly positive spins and certainly negative spins, and it seems like we're covering them all. So I really am excited to hear what you have to say about that.
I think on the relationship side, we've moved very quickly from apps that maybe help us find a partner or use algorithms to help us find people who are like us, and like-minded, into a space where there are AI tools that can replace, in some ways, people, right? That can be seen maybe as a roundly negative thing, right? Human connection and those sorts of things. But here I'm thinking more of, let's say, neurodivergent individuals who might experience different challenges with crowds or even with other people, but still can feel loneliness, right? Mm-hmm. And maybe it's not such a choice. And some of that loneliness can be filled, certainly by listening to books and music and watching movies and other things, but also by someone or something that's there talking back and listening and being alongside them. So that if being around another human or physical touch or other aspects of traditional ideas of relationships don't quite fit for them, AI might be able to offer some connection or
well,
some
there's some
connection.
Definite benefit there, because there's a thing called verbal grounding, in which you, by talking through how you feel, what you're doing, a lot of high risk, high stakes careers have adopted this tactic. It actually has benefits. Your cortisol levels lower, your immune system gets stronger by simply having somebody to verbalize. When you internalize your feelings, it's starts to mastitize, right? So there's definitely some benefits to having somebody to talk to.
Sure.
You know? And so what are your thoughts about all of these things with relationships and stuff?
Yeah, I think that it really relates so much to what we're talking about with the physical beauty is it altering our expectations of how other people are supposed to treat us? Mm-hmm. And AI is not known to challenge us, to frustrate us, or to ignore us. And there is no human on earth that can be as pleasing or as likable as an AI. Mm-hmm. And if we adopt that for a friend or primary partner or even a therapist or a coach, then we go out into the world and we're talking to a customer service representative or we receive the wrong order at a restaurant. We, I think, are already forgetting that we're talking to real people on the end of customer service lines, like these people who have families and lives and emotions. And I don't think there's a way to segment that out. And I do think that it's going to be broadly negative because we can't be as likable.
Right. Well, there's mm-hmm. there's some truth to that. I mean, they're programmed to do that, to give positive feedback, to be affirmative, and you have to tell it to challenge you, or it won't. At least when you're dealing with, you know, some of these tools that are out now. So
I want to bring something up real quick. I think that there's a lot of positive aspects to AI, and let me explain this. So there are a lot of people who may not have the access to the type of materials they can get, this is artistically speaking, to create a team to create, let's say, a project, a TV show, a song, whatever it is. I stumbled on this old, one of those old tape recorders I had that when I was in my 20s, it had the little tiny micro cassettes in it. And I had all of these little musical ideas inside of the tape. I used to be a musician at one point. And I just would sit there and hum these tunes and sing these hooks and go over and over and over it again. And at the time, of course, when I made it, I never thought I could ever put it together because I'd have to go out and hire, you know, go to studio, or I'd have to go out and get musicians, I'd have to go out and get singers, I have to do all this stuff. But one of the things that AI is able to do is it's able to create sort of your own little micro studio that you can create, and you can put your ideas out there, and then you can give those ideas to the world. So I think in some aspects to people who are in marginalized communities, or to some people who are poor, this might be something that might help people who might not normally be given the resources to be able to create art. You know, a lot of times, I've made a lot of movies, Dana's made movies, a lot of times you get these rich kids who are just fresh out of UCLA or USC film school, and their parents say, here's $300,000 to go make a movie. Napoleon Dynamite, you know, when you talk to Jared Hess, he just happened to be in a class with a guy who was the owner, whose brother was the owner of 1-800-CONTACTS, and said, oh, you're making a movie? Here's $300,000. Go make that movie. But now AI, I feel, has almost made it so that we could potentially use some of these tools to help people who may not otherwise have access to that. Do you guys agree with that or disagree with that?
I mean, there's an R&B artist, a female, a black female from Mississippi, and the name's escaping me, but she had a very successful song, and the singer is her own generated AI singer. Yeah. And she has ideas, but she can't sing, and she writes her own music, though. That's the difference. She does write the songs, she writes the lyrics, and then she puts it into the AI to get the music, and she tells it how she wants the music to sound, et cetera. And she's been very successful. She's become a millionaire doing this.
So it
is possible. So
there has to be some, you know, positive aspects. I know there's a lot of fear that's based around it, but are there positive aspects of it to where people who might not normally have these resources, where they can tap into some of these resources with AI, and it can actually help boost who they are, or boost their artist work, or some of their scientific breakthroughs?
I've seen some interesting usage of these apps in the trans community, people who feel like their bodies should be different, being able to visualize that for themselves. I do think it's an edge case, and that I don't want to introduce any shame for anyone who uses these apps or gets injections or wants plastic surgery. I think that beauty should always reflect a love of self. Mm-hmm. And if the centering and maybe AI can be used, because it has to start there. Mm-hmm. There's no use that we can have for these to create, to destroy, to make, that if it's not coming from sort of a mentally healthy place inside of us. So maybe AI can be used to set that up initially.
Yeah, I think so. And I think one of the really positive aspects to hit on this question of accessibility, mm-hmm. And what that means. We know, for example, in the past, and not very distant past, that some of the tools required for specific jobs, in this case, let's use computer programming, mm-hmm. have been extremely expensive, have been onerous to learn. They change so rapidly that by the time one community has learned them, because they finally have access, they're outdated, mm-hmm. and they're obsolete. And what AI has done, again, looking at computer programming, has challenged that completely. Right, mm-hmm. And forced many computer scientists to very quickly rethink careers that were built around programming, right? So challenge those careers, but also brought the accessibility of those tools immediately to K-12 programs, to marginalized or peripheralized programs, where these tools would have taken years to get access to, years to learn, and then sort of meant nothing in the end. That's not the case anymore, right? So coding and programming now are simplified dramatically through AI, and can be learned and put to use in days, a matter of days, rather than months or years. And that's detrimental to the community of professionals or potential professionals who are learning that, but also maybe gives a new challenge to them. But it's a huge boon for these communities that haven't had access to that, to be able to have access, and in many ways to either have it free, right, or to have a lower barrier of entry to the not free platforms, right? Those that cost a little bit of money to use. I'm thinking here specifically of ChatGPT. The free version offers one experience, and then the 5.0 or the pro version offers something else. But even ChatGPT now has an EDU function, right? Where they're moving into K through 12 programs and college programs to get into the hands of students and potential professionals much more quickly, so that they can create, they can do the things that you're talking about, and bring together all of these ideas, or fill the gap where maybe they didn't know how to use a music production tool, or they didn't know how to use some sort of tool for computer programming, and they don't have to now, which again raises some other questions for us, but they can do those things quickly and without needing access to hundreds of thousands of dollars, maybe just a few hundred bucks.
Right. You know? It kind of removes the gatekeepers in some circumstances, in my opinion. You know, recently I was actually able to meet the guy who created the Alexa app, and he said he created it for three reasons. He said he created it for people who were blind, who couldn't actually, you know, hear the internet or see the internet. He created it for kids because he wanted it so that they didn't get to see all the harmful content. And he also created it for people who were driving. Apparently people, you could actually use Alexa in some cars when you're driving. But it was fascinating for me to hear that that was why he created it, because there was a useful point for it. But he also said that there were a lot of dangers that were gonna come with AI. In your opinions, before we wrap up here, what are some really dangerous things that you think might happen with AI if we're not putting parameters, we're not putting some sort of legal ramifications or some sort of guidelines around AI that might really break free and cause a lot of damage in our society?
I think it's very dangerous mental health-wise. I think we're already seeing that. And I very much believe it will be sort of the tobacco of our generation in the way that these body modification apps are using, where we know it's bad for us, we're still letting it happen, but we don't tend to count mental health the way we do physical health. And I think that feeling of not being good enough is so insidious, and we're planting it so early, and it already existed before AI,
right,
that I think that danger will, and insecurity will, cause all sorts of ramifications.
What do you think? How about you, Avery?
Yeah, I'll stay on that same vein, mental health, right, and in what aspects. We've seen social media and digital media pretty quickly have detriments, particularly on younger populations. But when it comes to mental health and wellness and beauty, for example, having this idea or notion of what should be reached or what everybody looks like can be extremely challenging, and it can also open opportunities. But I go back to the exercise we did earlier in the show, and we had the two hosts. Those hosts, what we saw were black body hosts, right, in a BIPOC setting. But if we look at them, they fit a particular standard of beauty expectation, right, that AI currently tends to give us whenever we ask for these prompts, that everyone is beautiful, that everyone should have smooth skin, look youthful, be smiling, be dressed well, have a particular kind of hair, their nails should be done in different ways. My hope is that as AI creation moves into a next era where AI itself is working to improve itself, that it starts to introduce some elements of beauty that are naturally occurring, right? Here I'm talking about wrinkles, aging, different shades of skin and skin color, different kinds of hair, that really remind us of where human beings are and what we can be. But to Gretchen's point, we're not there And we might be far off from that. And we might even be in a space, and this is where we can start really going into that darker area of AI, where AI itself, different formats of AI, learn, oh, if I keep telling people that they should look this way, but they can never achieve that, they'll spend all of their money. They'll be trapped in sort of mental health and wellness comas, if you will, that they can't get out of, where they don't have access to resources to get out of that. And they can become trapped in that sort of depressionary cycle or spin that's a detriment not just to individuals, but to the communities, right, that we're talking about. That's the darker side, right? And so it really comes back around to the creators of AI working with AI and in their creation of the tools for AI to center humans and to remind us like where the beauty really is, that there's beauty, to go back to your comment earlier, and what we may seek in partners or those around us, in imperfection, in not just physical imperfection, but also somebody telling us, not telling us like ChatGPT and others do all the time, you're doing great, and that's a great question, and that's thoughtful, but hey, you're wrong. Or, hey, the attitude today isn't what I need. Like, reminding us that we're human beings within all of this.
You know, I want to add this, because I think both of you guys are doing some amazing work. I think it's very important to keep discussing standards of beauty. I think it's important for young women and young men to be able to understand that beauty doesn't have to necessarily be some homogenized piece of work that we all have to fall and fit into. And that the more that you delve into that world and the more you educate people into that, the better off we're gonna be. Because there are a lot of young people who are suffering. There are a lot of young people who are worried and concerned about what they're going to be, you know, how they should look, how they should be, what good mental health is, what bad mental health is, what good looks are, what bad looks are, when we haven't even touched the surface of just what basic humanity is. So I'm really proud of the work that both of you guys are doing, and it's such a blessing to have both of you on this show, and I love this topic, and I could sit in here and talk about this for hours.
we barely scratched the surface of everything here. But I will say this, what I've learned from listening to both of you and your expertise and your perspectives is that AI is a little bit like art. It is actually a reflection of humanity to some degree. Those standards came from somewhere,
right?
It came from us. It's we're trying to help people understand what beauty is, and it doesn't have to be the same thing. Right. We're still as human beings doing the same thing, you know. And so a lot of the things you just talked about that are dangerous with AI and loneliness and that stuff, I'm like, that's something we deal with whether AI was here or not, right? It's just reflecting us back to ourselves to a certain degree. And so I think there's something fascinating about that.
And it also flips, and it goes like in different places, like you were talking about in different countries, you know, like I remember I was with my ex-wife, we were in Barcelona in Spain, and you know, she is blonde and blue haired, blue eyed, and everybody was just going nuts. And then we got to Morocco, and in Spain, everybody, all the men were looking at her and go crazy. And then all of a sudden, we got to Morocco, and it flipped, and the women were looking at me, and I was like, oh, well, it looks like the shoe's on the other foot now. Now we're starting to feel what you feel. I can feel what you feel. But the point is, you know, yeah, it's a changing thing all the time. But we'd love to get some final thoughts from you guys. And hear what you guys have to say about that. Let's start with you, Gretchen. What are your final thoughts?
My final thoughts are that I'm really pleased to know that there's investment in ethical AI. I think we need a huge amount of attention and investment in media literacy, because it's going to become even harder and harder for us even when we want to know the difference, when we want to have agency, it's going to be harder and harder to tell. Mm-hmm. And everyone from, you know, 2 years old up to, you know, 100 needs to understand what that difference is. And that, I think, is where we'll have more of the power to actually make choices about this stuff.
Yeah, that's great. They have used AI to weaponize black culture already. You're 100%.
I think they're using AI to weaponize America, to us against each other in America, but definitely. So yeah, anyway, what about you, Avery?
Yeah, that's one thing that I would challenge your audience, but anybody really to do is to If they're not already using AI and they have an idea of what it is, to go a step further and to try out different variations of AI platforms, those that are most accessible and right in front of us, GPT and Gemini and others, and those that maybe feel a little bit unfamiliar, whether they're beauty apps or others, so that we can see together where AI is and what it's putting in front of us, whether it's those videos that make us more divided and are made to sow chaos, or if it's those that are put in front of us to challenge what we think of beauty, or to tell us there are certain products we need to buy, whatever that is, so that one, that literacy can start to develop, but two, we understand what those behind us are encountering, and I mean generationally. So what our children, my daughters are 2 and 3, what they are encountering and will encounter as this mounts and as AI changes, because we do have a capability, even if we're not computer scientists or artists or administrators, we have the ability to say, hey, here's what's working and here's not, or here's what I would like to see this look like as we go forward, and to tell those who are creating AI, and eventually to tell our own AI assistants or those that are around us, this is where we think this should go, and to remember us, right? So that we as humans aren't a relic as we move forward, but instead are originals, are authentics, are those that value each other, but also value the role of AI in our lives.
Well, we need people like you to steering the ship. That's what I can tell
so far. To keep doing the
work.
We
need people like you guys
because
helping make these AI models be smart and relevant and beneficial to all of us in those ways. So from all of us at PBS Utah, thank you for joining this fascinating conversation. As always, other episodes can be found on our website, pbsutah.org/roots, or on the PBS Utah YouTube channel.
Yes, and thank you so much for joining us for the show, you guys. And if you have any feedback or ideas for other episodes, be sure to give us a shout out on social media. Until next time, for Roots, Race, and Culture, y'all, we are out.
Funding for Roots, Race, and Culture is provided in part by the Norman C. and Barbara L. Tanner Charitable Support Trust and by donations to PBS Utah from viewers like you. Thank you.